Hello, I'm Parsa Mohri, welcoming you to Raise the Line with Osmosis from Elsevier, our ongoing exploration of how to improve health and healthcare. Today, we're continuing our NextGen Journey series, highlighting learners and early career healthcare professionals around the world and their fresh perspective on education, medicine, and the future of care. I'm thrilled to welcome Negin Farsio. Negin holds a BA in anthropology from UC Berkeley and will begin her master's in medical anthropology at Brunel University, London in fall 2025. Her path includes medical training experiences in London, Cyprus, and Curaçao, and her lived experience as both a patient and a caregiver shape her commitment to mental health, patient advocacy, and ethical, human-centered care. Many in the Osmosis community knew Negin from her work as a medical editor and as a fellow in the Osmosis Medical Education Fellowship Program, supporting healthcare learners worldwide. She's also curious about how neuropharmacology and AI can advance diagnostic practice. Without further ado, Negin, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be a part of this.
Likewise. So Negin, I'd like to start with, if someone were to ask, what do you do? How would you introduce yourself today?
Sure. Yeah. That is a very complex question that I do get asked. My most recent position was as an educational diagnostician, and I was working in that job for just over 2 years. And to be honest, I did not know what that job entailed before I started. Really what my role was to administer different types of testing to students of all ages. So as young as 5 years old to 26, 27, basically anybody in an academic setting. And it was usually kids who were having either behavioral problems or social or academic struggles in school. And my job was to administer different types of tests. So IQ tests, ADHD testing, autism testing, really to get an idea of where the student struggled in their work. And there was like a team basically of, it was like a multi-professional team of psychologists, therapists, speech language pathologists, occupational therapists. And I was kind of the first point of contact. So the kids would come to me, I would do a one-on-one testing session with them. And then we'd pass on the results. And then the rest of the team would kind of figure out what's the best way to support this child in the classroom.
That sounds like quite a holistic care, I would say, especially this is the sort of area that is not given that much of a focus, unfortunately, in hospital or healthcare setting. But this sounds very wonderful. And I was just wondering, in medical anthropology, for new listeners, kind of overlaps with public health, if I'm not mistaken, or I'm curious as to how they meaningfully differ.
So it's been about a month and a half now that I started a medical anthropology master's program. So I'm currently in London doing my master's. The reason I chose this route is I did my undergrad in anthropology, but I also did some medical training and decided it wasn't really working out for me the way I wanted. It wasn't exactly the right path for me. But medical anthropology is something where it kind of, it's a field that looks at healthcare systems around the world and kind of how human culture shapes the way we view different illnesses, different diseases, and also treatments. So you're right to say that there is a bit of an overlap with public health. I guess the difference is that public health kind of looks at a society and sees where are, you know, highs and lows in terms of getting the right care for people. It implements different, I would say, strategies or different like governmental tasks that go on to kind of address different issues that affect the health of the public. Whereas medical anthropology is more, I would say, a little more focused on the culture of a specific group or groups of people within that society and kind of addresses why they may or may not be benefiting from certain public health policies.
So in this part, it includes as well the tailored approach towards a population, taking also into account their culture, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. Because in essence, anthropology is the study of humankind and human culture. If you would ask any anthropologist, they would probably agree that the health setting is definitely one place where you do need kind of a holistic approach. You definitely do need to take into account culture, you know, social factors, political factors, and how those can actually shape the way that not only do people view illness, but also how they respond to different treatments, and also take into account that there's not always a cookie cutter type treatment for every person. Everybody has a unique background. And medical anthropology definitely aims to kind of see the full picture of each patient.
Wow. And I was wondering what first drew you to anthropology, and how has that sort of perspective or lens that you've got and changed the way you approach diagnosis and care of a patient?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I initially wanted to major in psychology for undergrad, because when I did do medicine, my end goal was always psychiatry. So when I was taking the required courses for psychology, I had to take a few anthropology courses, and I had no idea what anthropology was. So I was not too excited, but it was a requirement. So I took my first intro to social and cultural anthropology course, like in my second year of undergrad. And I instantly, I know it sounds really corny, but I instantly fell in love with it.
Oh, that's awesome.
I felt really conflicted at first, because I was like, this is something I definitely enjoy. It feels like a passion, and I'm not sure what to do now. So I ended up majoring in anthropology, and, you know, kept it on the table, where I thought always, you know, down the line, maybe I can do something with it. And that's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, see where it got you now. And that's, I love those sort of introduction towards a topic or a concept that at first it's like your blank, like Canva,
yeah,
but then eventually becomes like a very lovely artwork.
Yeah, I like that. It's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
So especially with your experience and training in London, Cyprus, and Curaçao, I wonder, how did each setting teach you about healthcare culture and sort of patient expectations?
So I did my medical training at a British university in Cyprus. So I was exposed to two cultures at once, because I was following like the British system of medicine, which is a little bit different than it is in the US, which is where I'm from. And also getting to know the Cypriot culture and the Cypriot views on health, and like just their own, you know, traditional ways of viewing health. So it was interesting, because that was the time where I felt my background in anthropology helped me the most, actually, because already I was kind of trained to view each patient holistically, and kind of see you know, how each background affects the patient and affects their own compliance from what the doctors may prescribe them, certain treatment, and they may or may not follow it. And you do kind of have to look at what are their reasons to follow or not follow, why do they have hesitations to follow or not follow what the doctor says, for example. Yeah, so it kind of just reinforced the idea that, you know, location, culture, and society has a huge, huge impact on how patients perceive their own health, and also how they will respond to what they're being told to do by the healthcare industry.
That's definitely something that should be given a bit more focus, especially with treatment compliances, or that trust that the patient has towards the healthcare policies, especially during COVID times. We've seen how the public has reacted quite differently towards new healthcare policies being introduced, or how different governments, though introducing similar policies maybe with their neighboring country, but the population's reaction or just how they introduced it had made such a big of a difference towards whether it's accepted or would be protested.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, COVID really shook things up. And I think it did a great job of showing us how there are some flaws in, I would say, every health system around the world has flaws. But I think the doctor-patient rapport is one where you can always improve, because it's not only, you know, treating the patient, but it's treating everybody that patient knows, and kind of like looking again at from a cultural perspective, how one interaction between patient and doctor can affect several other patients and doctors.
Absolutely. And I was wondering if you'd like to share a moment, whether from your own patient or caregiver experience, that helped reshape your path or ethics and practice or perspective.
Yeah. So I transferred out of Cyprus to come back to the States. So I transferred to Avalon University School of Medicine. I only did a bridge semester to kind of do like exam prep. That was right around the time that COVID was just starting off. And unfortunately, my father was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And it was like at the height of the pandemic when he was hospitalized for a few weeks. And that experience really kind of turns everything upside down for me, looking at health care in general, especially since I was a medical student at the time, and having these experiences where, you know, the healthcare professionals are not doing what I've been taught to do, or it wasn't as I expected. There was a lot of unfortunate experiences where we felt like we weren't being heard or not taken seriously. And this was, of course, like March of 2020. So it was like right at the height of the pandemic, then things were already chaotic. And unfortunately, my father did pass away a few months after that. But I kind of turned into an overnight caregiver, like literally just as soon as we brought my dad back home. It was like me and the rest of my family doing our best to take care of him. Because of COVID, we couldn't really have in-home nurses, or the contact was really minimal. So we kind of became his nurses, and I learned a lot about cancer care and patient care, and just how tough it really is to be like a full-time caregiver. And yeah, it definitely opened my eyes to different types of treatments and different approaches to cancer care, as well as different attitudes from different types of healthcare professionals. So ethics was definitely one of them, where there were some instances where I didn't feel like what was going on was super ethical, or I had questions and I felt like they were being disregarded. So it kind of, I would say, piqued my interest in patient advocacy, that whole experience did.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm very sorry, and express my condolences for your father.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It definitely, I think, gave a bit of a perspective towards the vulnerable populations when there's public policies, and how one like tends to treat the ones who could take care of themselves. But when it comes to the more vulnerable population, they're kind of forgotten, and the patients left with their own family members to be taken care of them.
Yeah, it is very true. Yes.
So we did touch base upon a bit of mental health, a bit of holistic health. And I was wondering if you have noticed some big gaps within this field, and whether you have a practical proposal to sort of address this that clinicians could be able to adopt tomorrow.
Yeah, something I'm very passionate about is mental health. I've had my own personal mental health struggles. I'm pretty comfortable talking about it at this point. But yeah, I've had obsessive compulsive disorder since I was a little kid, also known as OCD. And it is a very, unfortunately, very misrepresented and very misunderstood illness. And that causes a lot of issues, not just for the patient, because it is a difficult illness to deal with, but it also makes diagnosis harder and treatment even harder. And I think there's an average of like 10 to 15 years is how long it takes for someone with OCD to get an actual diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the past couple of years, my OCD has kind of flared up, especially, you know, dealing with grief from the passing of my father. Last year was a really difficult year for me in particular, and I kind of really had to face, you know, what it really means to encounter trauma and how to deal with mental health struggles when it's not so understood by those around you. And it took a lot of trial and error to find, you know, the right therapist, the right doctors, right medications, the right support that you need. And that was a whole other journey into patient advocacy, because it really, like you were talking about vulnerable populations, it really opened my eyes to, you know, people who do struggle with mental health issues. I am fortunate enough that I have, you know, family. I have safety nets backing me up. Like, I could take time off work if I needed to, but there are many people that can't do that. And it becomes a ripple effect where, you know, a lot of people become, they lose their homes, they lose their families. And it's just like a vicious cycle where, you know, they just keep suffering. So again, patient advocacy is not just about, you know, raising awareness, but it's also about being able to give a voice to those who are voiceless within not just mental health, but all any kind of health issues.
Very beautifully said. And you've probably seen it in your medical training or through your own personal experience, how some overlapping symptoms, whether it's mental health, initially one would think it's something probably organic, I should probably see a doctor for this, but it would never be caught. And it would usually just be shrugged off as if there's nothing wrong with you.
Right, yeah.
And I've especially seen it with patients who go to gastroenterology who are told in a quite of a harsh way, you need to see a psychiatrist.
Well, yeah, that's a common thread. I've heard that too, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's like instead of bringing the patient on board with what's going on, it's just sending them off like, this is no longer my problem.
Right.
Unfortunately. So that's definitely very, I think, relatable across the whole globe, the way how different cultures even approach the topic of mental health. Maybe in some parts quite holistic, maybe in some other parts quite unaddressed.
Yeah, for sure. And unfortunately, there's a lot of stigma surrounding mental illness, which just makes it a lot harder for patients to get the support they need. And also for, I would say on the opposite end, it makes it hard for the healthcare professionals to do the outreach that they need to reach the clients that need them the most.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you've mentioned earlier about being interested in psychology as well. Are there any developments within the field that you're looking forward to or any excitement?
Yeah, it's super interesting. Psychiatry and neurology in general, the brain is fascinating. So there's just constant news about what's going on and what people are discovering. Something that's really caught my attention this past year is I've noticed there's been a bit of a movement, I would say, in psychiatry towards different theories on how to taper off medications, certain like antidepressants, for example. I've seen a few like startups growing where there's like new research that shows if you're on a certain medication for a long period of time, it really alters your brain chemistry. And usually, like if you're trying to come off of a psychiatric medication, you'll be kind of guided to taper off within like a couple of weeks to like a month. But there now there's like new research showing that it takes much longer, like maybe years. Otherwise you might end up, I guess that's where the debate is if whether it's a withdrawal like months later or a relapse. So I personally had that experience where I was on a certain medication and I tried to come off of it and I was fine for the first month or so. And then I had really serious symptoms a few months later. So that really caught my interest, because it is interesting to see that, you know, maybe we are approaching the tapering off of medications, but maybe we're approaching it a little too, it's too quick. Maybe it needs some time.
That makes sense, because some people are definitely on it for years and to be told, yeah, you could taper out of it in just a matter of a few weeks and you'll be fine, is
right.
Definitely makes sense. why that sort of relapse would happen.
Exactly, yes.
And the topic that we cannot escape nowadays, the rapid advancements of AI within healthcare, especially you've probably heard in the news, some people have been using it as their own personal therapist since they cannot, they don't know who to turn to, unfortunately, or maybe they just don't have that resource to be able to seek treatment. I was wondering if there's any use cases that you're optimistic about or anything you'd like to just touch upon at the moment.
I think with any kind of new technology, there's going to be pros and cons. And I think it really depends on how we as humans use the technology. But I do see a lot of potential, like good potential with AI. And something that I've kind of seen it as more of a positive is getting a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have to take AI with a grain of salt. But, kind of thinking back to my own dad, when he first had some symptoms, his main and kind of really the only symptom he had was shoulder pain. And so it took, I don't know, a very long time, months, maybe over a year, to get the diagnosis that it was lung cancer. You know, he went to different physical therapists, orthopedics, and it took a long time to put together that it was referred pain. It wasn't actually shoulder pain. It was like his nerves. So I feel like sometimes there probably will be a lot of cases where you can just put in a few symptoms into, like, I don't know, ChatGPT or something, and just be like, what are all the possible differential diagnoses that I could have? Because I know that if he had been diagnosed sooner, we may have had more time with him. So, in terms of diagnosis, I think it would be, and we've got a long way to go, I think, but I think we're getting there. And I think AI could definitely be helpful in providing the right guidance of where you should go if you have certain symptoms and who you should see. Mm-hmm. And same with like a mental health as well. Like you said, a lot of people use it kind of as a personal therapist. I think if anything, it's just unfortunate because it shows how people don't have access to the mental health support that they actually need. Mm-hmm. But again, you kind of have to be careful with how we use technology, because on one hand, it could be great, if it helps people reduce their anxiety, for example, great. Sometimes, though, it might steer you in the wrong direction. It really depends on what exactly you are struggling with. So, like, I guess the case for someone with schizophrenia would be a little bit different if they go to AI for guidance versus someone who just needs, like, a little bit of help with calming down their anxiety.
Absolutely. So I've mentioned, and as you've had experience with being part of the production of the content on Osmosis, I was wondering if there's some content gaps that you see in our offerings, or which topics you would love us to cover a bit more next.
Yeah, I'm pretty biased because I've loved Osmosis from the start. I was a huge fan when it first came out. It helped me so much in medical school. It's not like a typical, I would say, medical like education platform, because it is very holistic and it covers a lot of areas that a lot of other websites, for example, they don't go into. They kind of just do content, but Osmosis goes beyond content. Like academic content. And I think it would be great. I think Osmosis already kind of do this, where they talk a bit about, you know, different types of professions, and it's very tailored to different types of healthcare professions. I think it would be great to have like a series of maybe lesser known healthcare professions or different fields where you can apply medicine, like once you get that education. For example, I'm again going to be a little biased here, but like medical anthropology, because most people don't know what it is, but I think it is something that could definitely be applied within the healthcare setting, because it would help not only patients but also the healthcare professionals kind of come to more common ground.
Absolutely, I agree on that, and we've discussed, I think, a lot of very relevant, very important topics. And I was wondering, what's one thing you would want our listeners to take away from this episode?
Oh boy, one thing. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, follow your passion, whatever it is. It may take you exactly where you wanted to go, but you just didn't know. So, you know, if you like one thing and you end up doing something else and then you kind of get rerouted, you know, it's a journey. Things change. I never saw this plan for myself. You know, my end goal was always psychiatry. I never saw anything beyond that. And I am still interested in mental health, but I feel like now I have a more diverse background and a better background to approach mental health with. So yeah, keep an open mind when you are deciding what it is that you want to do. And you don't have to stick to just one thing, especially nowadays. I feel like different fields are being so beautifully integrated that you can always kind of create your own path. You can create your own career even.
I wish I was told that a long time ago. That's very well said, Nagin. Thank you very much, Nagin, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Parsa Mohri. Thanks for checking out today's show. Remember to do your part to raise the line and strengthen the healthcare system. We're all in this together.
If you like this podcast, please share it on your social channels. You can also subscribe to the series and check out all of our episodes at osmosis.org/raisethelinepodcast.